popping back up to look at Flores. They just argued. About what? About whether or not to kill me. For what reason? Because I'm a witness. A witness to what? Him. To Travis, Arias said, cupping her face in her hands. Travis's murder? Yeah, but I didn't really witness it. I didn't see much, she said, hiding her face in her hands as if frightened at the recollection. You need to make this believable, because this is not believable to me right now, Flores directed. You need to give me something. Arias seemed eager to indulge the detective. Okay, just listen. Jody, I am listening, and it doesn't make any sense to me. People just don't go in somewhere and kill somebody for no reason and then let a witness go. That doesn't happen. They've already killed one person, why not just take care of the other? You know who they are, if you are telling me the truth. I don't know them. Then I don't believe you. I can't. You can't expect me to. As if to buy more time, Arias then launched into a long-winded rendition of the events of June 3rd, her first day on the road, beginning with her departure from Wairika and going through her arrival at Travis's house in the middle of the night. After arriving there, she said they slept in until about 1 p.m. The next day, June 4th, and almost immediately upon waking, they engaged in sexual interplay, which, as she told Flores earlier, included videotaping as well as photographs. At least this part of her story appeared to have been true, since the photographs from the camera confirmed them posing nude starting around 1:30 in the afternoon. She claimed afterward that they went downstairs to his study, where they tried to view some CDs that she had brought with her, containing pictures of various trips they had taken. But they were having problems because either the computer couldn't play them, or the CDs were damaged. It was around this time that they engaged in sex for a second time. She said they went back upstairs, where Travis shaved before he took a shower. As he stood in the shower, she convinced him to allow her to use his newly purchased camera to photograph him. She believed that the photograph of him with the water running down his face was a very nice image. That was where her story took a drastic detour, once again stretching the boundaries of credulity. As she knelt down outside of the shower reviewing the photos, she said she heard a pop, and almost simultaneously felt a strike to the back of her head, which she believed caused her to lapse into unconsciousness for a short period of time. Upon regaining consciousness, she saw two attackers wearing ski masks, a man and a woman, one armed with a gun and one armed with a knife. She turned her attention to Travis and realized that he had been shot and was screaming and bleeding profusely. He told her to go to his neighbors and go get help. She did not follow his instruction because, she said, the attackers prevented her from leaving. According to her story, in the middle of this melee, the male attacker took the time to find her purse and rummage through it, looking to find her identification information. He found both her driver's license and car registration, which included her parents' address in Wairika. She was then told by the male attacker that she must be that bitch from California, leading her to believe they somehow knew her. She immediately became afraid for her family and decided to follow the attacker's instructions. After returning the registration and driver's license to her purse, the male attacker went through the pockets of her Levi's, which she claimed were in a backpack she had brought with her, and found $80, which he pocketed. According to her, the attack took a more serious turn when the female assailant tried to convince her companion that Arias should also be killed. But he prevailed, saying, "That's not why we are here." At some point, Arias claimed that she began to fight with the woman, who apparently was now holding the knife. Although Arias was barefoot and unarmed, she appeared to have escaped the encounter unharmed, with the exception of a cut to one of the fingers on her left hand. The attackers finally decided to let her leave with a stern warning, counseling against telling anyone what she had just lived through. They allowed her to take her purse and backpack and shoes and leave out the front door, apparently confident that their threats would silence her and stop her from calling police to aid a dying Travis. "You just left? You didn't run to the neighbors? You didn't try calling?" Flores asked with a tone of disbelief. "You knew they were in his house. You had time to run to the neighbor. Why didn't you do that?" "I was really scared," Arias whined. "I was freaked out of my mind." "I don't believe you," he responded in a raspy godfather-type voice, extending his left hand to emphasize his point. "I came in here hoping you would tell me the truth, and this is not the truth, Jody." After some final back and forth, Flores left the room, and the lined legal pad he had left behind on the table became the focus of her attention. Tearing three sheets from the pad, she folded them and stuck them in the chest pocket of her orange top. But when she looked down at them, she appeared to realize that they would be visible to anyone who entered the room. So she tucked them into the waistband of her orange pants, making sure her top was covering them. When Detective Blaney entered the room a few moments later, she asked if Arias had any paper. The police had been monitoring her from outside the room and saw what she'd done. Arias hesitated for a moment before lifting her top to reveal the hidden papers. Although Blaney ultimately allowed her to keep the items, her attempts to hide them showed she had no compunction about trying to get away with as much as she could, even if it was something as insignificant as three sheets of paper. Approximately 2 weeks later, Arias mailed a letter from the jail to Travis's grandmother, Norma Sarvey, who lived in Riverside, California. Interestingly enough, Arias listed the return address on the envelope as her parents' address on Oregon Street, although the jail's official address was stamped in black ink over her handwritten one. "Of all the letters I must write, this is one of the most difficult, second only to the one I must write to my parents." Arias began the 18-page handwritten letter, which was dated Monday, July 28, 2008, which would have been Travis's 31st birthday. "I don't have all of the answers that you seek," the letter began, "but as I sit here today and put pen to paper, even on Travis's birthday, I'm going to try to answer as many as I can. Since things have culminated in this way, and since the detectives have already made it clear that my case is hopeless and theirs rock solid, I have no reason to hold anything back at this point." She proceeded to provide a brief synopsis of the history of her relationship with Travis. "I met Travis at the Rainforest Cafe at the MGM in September 2006. We later marveled and mused at the irony of meeting in such a place, as we later discovered our mutual passion for a healthy planet and the environment in general. He confidently walked right up to me, stuck out his right, and said, 'Hi, I'm Travis.' I cordially responded with the usual niceties and figured that would be it, since in that moment he was just another of the many new names I was trying not to forget." Arias claimed she didn't feel any sort of magnetic attraction to him, but also did not turn her back on his entreaties. Although she tried to meet and mingle with other people, he monopolized her attention by walking alongside her and keeping up a running conversation. In the short time they talked, they discovered they had a few things in common: traveling, the 49ers, the UFC, and the drive to create an amazing life. She said she didn't expect to hear from Travis again, but surprisingly, he called her the very next day. As she described it, the relationship was on a very fast track. Within days, he invited her to spend the weekend at the home of his friends, Sky and Chris Hughes, in Murrieta, California, one of the reasons being so that she could attend church with them, and the following Wednesday, he gave her a copy of the Book of Mormon. By November 2006, Travis was baptizing her as a Mormon at the church in Palm Desert, California. "He said he'd never met anyone more prepared to receive the gospel," she wrote. She was very happy because she claimed joining the LDS Church was one of the best decisions she ever made. I know that Travis will be richly rewarded for the role he played in bringing me into the fold. Arias explained that they were mutually attracted, but they were not officially dating. By Christmas of 2006, Travis had grown to mean a lot to her. For his part, he was determined to Mormonize her, so he gave her gifts to serve that purpose, including a CTR ring and scriptures with her name engraved on them, a painting of Jesus Christ, and a biography of Church President Gordon B. Hinckley. His generosity never wavered the entire time that I knew him, not once. Arias wrote in that same letter that on February 2, 2007, they began to officially date. Things went really well despite one small hang-up. Deanna Reed. Deanna Reed was one of Travis's former girlfriends, whom he had dated during two separate periods, and the two had remained very close friends. According to the letter, she and Travis even talked of marriage. This included discussions about baby names and the number and sexes of children they wanted. She believed this was a natural progression. According to her letter, in May 2007, Arias could no longer handle the mortgage of her home in Palm Desert, and she had to move out. Travis insisted that I move closer to him so that we could have a more normal relationship. Although he expressed concern for Deanna's reaction, saying that if she found out, it would be World War III. The two took a trip to Daniels Summit, Utah, in June 2007, and after their return, according to Arias, she did something completely dishonest. I acted on an impulse and a gut feeling. You see, I had been in a few relationships before when my partner was not being completely faithful, and there is a distinct feeling that comes with it. Travis had been interacting with some girls in my presence that gave me cause or concern. I knew he was a flirtatious type, and I had witnessed it on countless occasions prior to that point. I am not a jealous person, but something about the way he conducted himself at that time caused me to question his level of commitment to our relationship and to me. The dishonest deed that I had mentioned was that I looked at the text messages in his phone. I thought to myself, he said he had nothing to hide, so why not? A flawed logic, I know. I fully expected to find a few mild flirtations with other girls, as this was his M.O. anyway, and he was not secretive about it. What I found, however, was far more, including several references made of the many separate intimate rendezvous he had with other girls, including plans in the making for further associations of the same kind. Arias said she attempted to verify that he had been dishonest by checking the dates. As she feared, the activities that she'd uncovered had been during the time they had been dating, supposedly exclusively. But rather than confront Travis, she chose to go on vacation with him, and they traveled to Niagara Falls and the Sacred Grove in New York State, as well as to Huntington Beach, California. It was only after they returned from their trip that she spoke to him about her concerns. Although he was very apologetic, she found there was no way she could forgive him. So she broke up with him on June 29, 2007, because she could not trust him. This was a very difficult decision for me because I loved him very much. It was especially difficult because he begged me to marry him that same day. Up to that point, a proposal was expected at any time, but once the trust is gone, it is hopeless. In July 2007, Arias wrote, she decided to move to Mesa after Travis persuaded her to make the move, reiterating the story she'd told Flores. She used to wonder what it would have been like to accept his marriage proposal, but she didn't think things would have changed, because a month before she moved back to California, in April of 2008, she and Travis had a conversation about previous relationships, and he confessed that most of the time that she'd been living in Mesa, he'd been dating Lisa Andrews. She had asked him about it, and he had lied by telling her he wasn't dating anyone. She said she'd never had a reason not to believe him, so she couldn't understand why he hid it from her, since she was not the type to have a crying, emotional meltdown over something like that. She would have been happy for him. The shock that she experienced was related not to the fact that he had lied again, not that he cheated on yet another girlfriend, but that this time she was the other woman, and it made her feel ashamed. Arias claimed her first thought was not of herself, but of poor Lisa. She said she even thought about telling her, but decided that it would destroy her relationship with Travis and cause a lot of unnecessary drama and pain. According to Arias, when it was her turn to come clean, his attitude changed and all hell broke loose. He lost his temper completely and flew into a rage. He began punching himself in the head so hard that he injured his neck and his back and could barely turn his head from side to side. She even claimed that he beat her on two separate occasions, but she never told anyone about it because he was not her partner any longer, and besides, it would be a matter of days before she rolled out of town in a U-Haul truck. I know you all probably hate me even more than before you started reading this letter. Arias wrote on page 8 of the 18-page attempt to exonerate herself in the eyes of Travis's grandmother. Well, hang on, because the plot thickens, and by the time you're done reading this, you most likely won't consider me worthy of your own spit. She went on to describe Travis's killing in the same fashion as she did to Detective Flores, with a few embellishments. In this version, the male assailant held the gun to my head and tried to fire, but nothing happened. Just a click. She also detailed a scuffle with the female attacker, who she claimed came at her with a knife, and during the struggle, stomped on her bare feet. I didn't notice the pain. Maybe it was adrenaline, but my left foot was later throbbing and bruised, so I know she got me at least once, probably more on that foot, and she had caused two of the toenails on my other foot to bleed, which I didn't discover until later as well. She also claimed that she felt awful because she hadn't looked before backing out of the driveway as she fled the scene. I probably should have never been driving in that kind of state. Her seemingly heartfelt letter sent to Travis's grandmother, supposedly offering solace, appeared more like a taunt as she described a scenario that was impossible to believe. Chapter 8. Almost 2 years after Travis's murder, the case should have been ready to go to trial according to the timeline set out in the Arizona Rules of Criminal Procedure. The police reports had been reviewed, witness interviews were underway, and Jody Arias's version of events had been consistent ever since she told Flores that she had merely been present when two strangers broke in and killed Travis. But in spring 2010, the defense began to shift in ways that would permanently alter the makeup and tone of this case. These changes had actually started to take root in August 2009, when Arias's initial court-appointed counsel was allowed to withdraw. And a second set of attorneys, also appointed by the court, took over the defense. Lawrence Nurmi was assigned as lead attorney, with Victoria Washington assisting him. I didn't know much about either attorney, our paths had never crossed before, but I understood that Nurmi was qualified to represent defendants charged with a capital crime. On the face of it, the presence of these new attorneys wasn't particularly significant because my interactions with Arias's defense team were fairly limited. As is standard, the only time I would usually see them was during our periodic status conferences, which occurred every 30 to 45 days. During these appearances, the prosecution and defense were asked to update the judge on their progress and alert the court to any problems that had arisen. In these conferences, neither side is required to disclose details of the approach or tactics they intend to use, enabling the prosecutor and defense counsel to pursue avenues that best advance their cause without having to tip their hand. But with the arrival of these new attorneys came new requests. The prosecution is required to provide defense counsel copies of police reports, photographs, and other documentary items. Over the course of this prosecution, more than 2,400 pages of documents alone were provided to defense counsel. The state is also required to list the names and addresses of those it expects to testify at trial. Defense counsel has a similar duty to disclose the claims that will be advanced at trial, along with the names of persons who may be called to testify for their side. Their disclosure obligation includes providing the state with copies of any materials that they think are important and might be used at trial. In April 2010, Arias's defense counsel requested that the prosecution provide text messages from Travis's cell phone and instant messages and emails from his computer. The production of this electronic correspondence proved problematic for different reasons. Technology had not advanced sufficiently to allow recovery of the text messages without making it unduly burdensome and extremely time-consuming. As for the instant messages and email, the service provider, in this case Google, had ignored the subpoena I sent requesting the correspondence. Eventually, each of these issues was resolved once the electronic correspondence was made available to the prosecution, allowing for copies to be made and turned over to the defense. The state provided defense counsel with thousands of texts, emails, and instant messages from Travis's various accounts. It was a massive trove of information, with the messages and emails covering everything from the mundane to the inflammatory. What emerged was a portrait of a tumultuous relationship, one laced with sexual overtones and bad feelings on both sides. The instant messages were particularly troublesome because they portrayed Travis as someone who may have verbally crossed the line of good taste, as he and Arias argued via electronic means. In one angry instant messenger chat between the two, on May 26, 2008, Travis complained that Arias was nothing but a liar from the beginning. It was clear that she had done something to upset him greatly, but that catalyst wasn't discernible from the lengthy exchange. What was clear was that Travis felt that she had lied to him. "Travis, you have not felt as much pain in all your life than what you have repeatedly caused me with your lies and your invasions and the psycho shit you have subjected me to. Travis, you have made me want to die. Travis, on countless occasions. You have hurt me so bad over and over again. And how do you repay me for giving you by doing the same thing? Couldn't you ever try to love me? You only showed that you hated me. Never love. Only hate. Your words were lies. Can't you just tell the truth?" Throughout the entire exchange that followed, Arias avoided answering Travis's ongoing requests for the truth. Instead, she portrayed herself as the victim, writing, "Jody, there have been times when you've screamed into the phone so loud at me that the speaker was distorted, and then you hung up. The pain was so sharp and so deep that I just couldn't process it. I could only scream in response to the air, and I would scream at the top of my lungs until my throat was raw, 'I hate you, I hate you, I hate you,' until I had no energy left to say it, and it had whittled down to a little wimp, 'I hate you.' And I just sobbed and cried until I couldn't breathe. Jody, but you know what? I deserved all of that. Every angry phone call, every unpleasant word. Jody, doesn't compare to what I've put you through." The conversation continued with Travis attempting to get Arias to admit that she had slashed his tires. He also accused her of stealing his journals. At one point, Travis's frustration with Arias's refusal to take responsibility was boiling over when he said, "Write something, you stupid idiot!" Arias picked this moment to respond, "I may be a liar, I may be a whore, I may be evil, I may be a coward, I may not be worth the air I breathe. I am most like the most horrible person you've ever had the misfortune of knowing, but one thing I am not is violent. I did not and would never slash your tires. This appears to infuriate Travis, who again demands that Arius tell the truth. The heated exchange continues for several more pages until his anger finally boils over and he lashes out in derogatory fashion, calling her a three-hole wonder. The first time I read those words, I realized that they were extremely harsh, so I went back to the beginning of this section of the conversation to understand the context of the remark. The way this conversation had been reproduced required it be read from the bottom of the page to the top, rather than the customary top to bottom. This time I read the conversation from top to bottom rather than the way I had been reading it before. I wanted to make sure that I hadn't been mistaken, that Travis had actually referred to Arius in this way. Either way I read it, it brought me to the same uncomfortable place. While I understood from the conversation that Travis had made the comment in anger, it felt inappropriate under any circumstance because it was so derogatory. Even if they were talking in a sexual context, and even if Arius prompted the comment by saying she was a whore, it still didn't lessen its impact. It was the kind of comment that could shape a jury's opinion and garner sympathy for Arius. I took solace in the belief that this comment would probably not be admissible at trial because it was hearsay and would unfairly go into an area of Travis's character that had nothing to do with the killing. Up to this point, Arius was still maintaining that Travis had been killed by two intruders as he posed for pictures in the shower, so his being verbally abusive to Arius was irrelevant to the reason he was murdered. In the same conversation, Travis also indicated that he felt he was meaningless to her, writing that he was little more than a dildo with a heartbeat to you. It seemed that Travis had very conflicted feelings about his sexual relationship with Arius and believed that she had been using him for her sexual gratification. Arius was no shrinking violet and pushed the sexual envelope by sending Travis explicit text messages encouraging the sexual interaction between the two. She sent the following on February 25, 2008. The things I had to do today consisted of waxing my pussy so it was nice and smooth, just in case, showering so I was fresh and clean for you. Arius sent other text messages along the same lines in January and February 2008. Will do. The reason I was asking about later tonight is because I want to give you a nice BJ, and I'd like a generous facial in return. What do you say? Oh my gosh, that is so freaking hot, I want to lick it up and then sit on it. You are so tasty. My goodness. Oh yes, I want to fuck you like a dirty, horny little schoolgirl.
Although Arius may have been a willing participant in their sexual repartee, defense counsel's inordinate interest in Travis's texts, instant messages, and emails hinted that they might be contemplating a change in strategy and moving away from the story that Arius had been alleging for the nearly 2 years since her arrest. Another change in her story would be risky because it would contradict both her allegations to Flores that two masked intruders killed Travis and the tale she'd told during interviews with two national television news magazines, in which she said the same thing, tying herself to that fantastical rendition of events. One of the TV interviews had actually occurred in Yreka less than a month after she was taken into custody, when she had granted a jailhouse interview to 48 hours. She then did a follow-up interview at that same news show in September 2008, after her extradition to Phoenix. She also spoke to Inside Edition around the same time as the second interview with 48 Hours. Her interview with Inside Edition aired first. Arius, dressed in black and white striped jail garb, her long brown hair neatly brushed and falling over her shoulders, smiled demurely as she emphatically proclaimed her guiltlessness.
I know that I am innocent. God knows that I'm innocent. Travis knows I'm innocent. I absolutely did not kill Travis Alexander. I had nothing to do with his murder. I didn't harm him in any way.
She again went on to tell the story of two assailants who entered Travis's home and
attacked us both.
In a nutshell, two people took Travis's life. Two monsters, she claimed, her voice never higher than a raised whisper. As believable as her denials may have sounded, what was most compelling about this interview was her indignation. No jury is going to convict me, she said with certainty. She then followed up this statement with an even more emphatic one. Because I'm innocent. You can mark my words on that one. The interview with 48 Hours aired some months later, and it was telling for totally different reasons. When asked about her childhood, Arias described an idyllic upbringing and maintained that she and her parents and siblings were very close. I couldn't help but think back to the interviews Detective Flores had conducted with Sandy and Bill Arias, and how they had described a secretive, disrespectful daughter who had been shutting them out of her life since she was 14. As far as I was concerned, here was yet another indication that she would make things up if it suited her, even under inconsequential circumstances such as a media interview. More importantly, though, she had made it difficult to present a story of an abusive childhood as a possible excuse for her behavior, or to help understand the killing, because she had told a national audience something contrary to what Bill and Sandy had expressed to police. Her statements had served to effectively preclude her parents from testifying at trial, because the idyllic family portrait she had just painted for the television audience was in stark contrast to the statements her parents had made to police about her inability to get along with her mother and being extremely secretive. When it came to the murder of Travis Alexander, Arias stuck to her story, continuing to adamantly deny any plans to visit Travis in Arizona on that fateful day. She again recited her masked intruder story, making sure it was consistent with the one given to Detective Flores and to Inside Edition. In addition to the incredible nature of the story itself, her failure to alert police immediately or to tell them about the two intruders during her first interviews with Detective Flores continued to stand out as problematic. It sounded more like a slip of the tongue than a reason when she told the interviewer she hadn't called the police because she didn't want to implicate herself. The highlight of the 48 Hours interview was the assertion that she intended to take the witness stand and testify at trial. That told me that she was confident in her public speaking abilities and that she believed she was persuasive enough to make the charges go away just by telling her story. She was masterful in front of the camera, playing the part of someone who couldn't have committed this murder. The way she could look straight at the camera lens and answer the interviewer's questions with apparent sincerity was impressive. She clearly wasn't going to be intimidated. I don't believe that I am going to be convicted, she confidently told 48 Hours' Maureen Maher, just as she had advised the interviewer from Inside Edition. I don't think that I'm going to spend one day in prison. While she hadn't given another interview in the almost two-year span since these aired, her initial decision to tell her story to the media had elevated both the case and her account to mythical heights. It was one thing to concoct this kind of narrative when confronted with overwhelming evidence during a police interview, but quite another to volunteer those same claims to a national audience. The account of the masked intruders had become synonymous with the case. Perhaps the feedback from Arias's TV interviews, which called into question the believability of her story, led her and her defense counsel to rethink their approach in defending the case. Even though no notice of a change in defense had yet been filed with the court, I could see that one was in the offing. The graphic and hurtful nature of the text messages, IM chats, and emails had the potential to taint Travis's reputation and character, which would only be relevant if Arias changed her existing story. It didn't take much to foresee that defense counsel were considering self-defense as an option. Pleading self-defense would allow Arias to say that Travis was such a bad person he deserved what she doled out to him on June 4, 2008. It appeared from their requests for the electronic correspondence that defense counsel was motivated by their intent to use Travis's words to cast him into the role of villain, a role they would insist he play. And Arius was being recast as a victim, a role she'd sought as hers from the beginning of the case. In June 2010, not long after the email and text messages were made available, defense counsel made an unexpected disclosure to me. It was printouts of 10 letters they had received via email on Sunday, April 11, 2010, from someone with an email address identifying himself as Bob White. Accompanying the letters was a single sentence written by White, ostensibly seeking to distance himself from the case. "I came across these, but don't want to be involved." As indicated in the public filings, each of the letters attached to the email was supposedly written by Travis, where he mentions sexual acts and fantasies and admits conduct that would be considered deviant or unlawful. By order of the court, the content of the letters was sealed on July 15, 2010. Anyone can create an email account under a fictitious name, and it seemed that was the case in this instance, because Bob White was never identified beyond the name provided on the electronic correspondence. Even more suspect was that the whereabouts of the original letters was never disclosed by defense counsel. The method in which they came to light and the fact that the letters were not originals immediately raised a red flag and signaled that an investigation into their authenticity was in order. 3 weeks after the disclosure of the Bob White letters, defense counsel advised me through a notice of defenses filed with the court that they would now pursue a justification defense related to domestic violence, commonly known as self-defense. Despite previously claiming she either hadn't been at the scene or that the killing was committed by intruders, Arius was changing her story again and now admitting that she had killed Travis and had done so for a justifiable reason. In her latest version of events, Travis became angry and attacked her, making her fear for her life because she dropped his camera while she took pictures of him in the shower. She admitted that no one else had been in the bathroom with them, contrary to what she had told Detective Flores back on July 16, 2008, when he interviewed her in Wairika. Arius was also claiming that on several occasions, Travis sexually and physically abused her and had slapped her and choked her. This was in sharp contrast to the Travis Alexander she had previously described to Detective Flores during their telephone conversations and her face-to-face interviews with him. Changing stories would normally be the death knell for a defendant because any testimony with inconsistent stories would surely be rejected by a jury. Except that Jody Ann Arius was different in her physical appearance, affect, and demeanor, and was skilled at making the implausible seem true. Any questioning of her would be extremely difficult because, as I had seen in her interviews and phone calls, she could seamlessly meld the truth with her untruths, making her statements seem consistent. Getting at the truth in court would be especially difficult because there were just two people present in Travis's bedroom on June 4, 2008, and only one of them, Jody Arius, was alive to tell her story. The challenge was all the more daunting because it included discrediting her assertion that Travis was a cad who hit her at times and spoke to her in a demeaning tone, as illustrated by some of the text messages and instant messenger conversations now available. The clanging of his three-hole wonder comment in particular reverberated loudly, as it provided support for her allegation that Travis was abusive, making for what appeared to be an almost insurmountable hurdle. Given the damning electronic conversation, I had to admit that Arius's self-defense claim seemed to have a chance of succeeding. Providence seemed to have miraculously come to her aid through these 10 letters purportedly written by Travis, and it was no coincidence that her claim of self-defense arose shortly after her defense counsel received Bob White's email containing the prejudicial letters. If they could be authenticated and the acts described within them proven to be true, I knew they would present a nearly impossible hurdle to clear at trial. Jurors might even acquit Arius in reaching their verdict if they believed Travis was a reprehensible individual who had been abusing her. Chapter 9. People would be amazed at the stories I hear in this job. Everything from situational amnesia, where the accused claims he or she cannot remember anything about the crime, to denying his or her presence at the crime scene when there are pictures or video to prove otherwise. It is never easy to tell when a person is telling the truth, and the task becomes even more difficult when the individual has nothing to lose and everything to gain by being deceitful. Jodi Arias's filing with the court, announcing her new strategy, left me with little recourse but to go back and re-examine the police investigation more closely, as well as review any other information I might not have previously read. I had already amassed a voluminous amount of material, more than in any other case I could remember. Nearly a dozen three-ring binders full of investigative materials, file folders stuffed with photographs and documents, and stacks of miscellaneous papers crowded the bookcases that spanned nearly an entire wall of my small office. A quick re-examination of the police materials yielded no evidence of any claim of domestic abuse, other than her expressed disappointment to Detective Flores at learning that Travis had been communicating with other women during their relationship. She had offered nothing but compliments and praise for the man she was now claiming had abused and terrorized her. While it contradicted her current claims, this alone would not be enough to discount her assertions. I needed to find some concrete proof that I could hold up in front of a jury to repudiate her allegations. Everything the Mesa Police Department had done in their investigation had focused on placing Arias at the scene of the crime and proving she had been the one who killed Travis. With her change in strategy, she was effectively sticking her tongue out at them, negating the importance of the evidence they had already collected and presenting me with a wholly different task. Nothing in the photographs, police reports, or countless other documents addressed the issue of self-defense, so much of the investigative material was now of little use to me. A sense of alarm began to take hold. Standing before the bookcases in my office, I slowly recited the labels on the black binders lining the shelves. Photographs, cell phone records, text messages, Arias's statements. It felt as though I were standing on a lunar landscape pockmarked with gaping craters, having been shipwrecked there with no way of returning back to Earth. My concern over the state of the case was compounded by my knowledge of how well Arias had handled herself when faced with incontrovertible evidence and pointed questions. I had spent hours studying the interviews she had done with Detective Flores at police headquarters in Yreka, and I had reviewed the raw footage of her stellar performances during her two jailhouse interviews with 48 Hours. Even though the story she was now telling was different from the one she'd told on those previous occasions, she was quite good at playing the victim. I started by revisiting everything the police had done, trying to identify avenues that could possibly have been explored had the investigation not been so duly focused on proving that Arias was the killer. I knew this was counterproductive, so I took a few hours out of the office, hoping that something I hadn't yet thought of would crystallize. Upon my return, I found myself back in front of the bookcases once again. Placing some of the binders I had already skimmed back onto the bookcase, I noticed a large manila envelope inside an accordion folder on the second shelf. Inside were more than 300 pages of background material that had been provided to me by Arias's first defense team months earlier as part of the discovery process. Because these reports were intended as an argument for why Arias should be shown leniency if faced with the death penalty, I hadn't reviewed them in detail, but had merely browsed them. Typically, I don't review in depth anything for the sentencing phase of the trial this early in the proceedings while I'm preparing for the guilt phase. But the vulnerability of the case as it currently stood compelled me to take a closer look. The materials included Arius's work and educational histories, dozens of photographs, and interviews with family members, a friend, and two ex-boyfriends. All of the interviews had been conducted between October 23, 2008 and April 26, 2009 by an investigator working on Arius's behalf, and were sent to me in summary form, so I couldn't read the actual text of the discussions. If the interviews had been recorded, I hadn't been provided with any of the audio tapes. As this material had been assembled to illustrate why Arius didn't deserve the death penalty, I was aware that it was meant to present her in the best possible light, so I didn't expect to find much that would be helpful in discrediting her self-defense allegation. Probably because there was nowhere else to look, I decided to wade through the pages and started reading the contents whenever I could find time. Because I was carrying a caseload that included other prosecutions, I had to carve out reading time in between my court appearances, witness interviews, phone calls, and filing of responsive pleadings. I am methodical when it comes to reading case materials, and I have acquired habits that help me with this tedious process. I close the door to my office to avoid the need to constantly look up every time someone walks by and to muffle the noises from the copy machine just outside my door. I turned off the ringer on my cell phone so I could devote my full attention to the materials, and with a black rollerball pen in hand, I began to read. I started my review by looking at Arius's employment history, which showed that she had worked mostly as a food server in various restaurants in Arizona as well as California. It struck me that she was probably doing a job she did not enjoy, as she had floated from restaurant to restaurant, only staying for several months at each. Her more recent employment records included documented disciplinary actions that, in at least one case, had resulted in her termination. Mimi's Cafe in Mesa had fired her for unpleasantness and services issues. As she acknowledged in one of her journals, "I got 2 complaints in 3 days. They said I wasn't smiling enough and that I didn't seem happy. That's probably the case." Employment records from P.F. Chang's China Bistro, also in Mesa, showed that her lack of attentiveness towards her tables has led to refills being missed. The owner of the Purple Plum in Wairika, one of the 2 places Arius had been employed just prior to Travis's death, told the defense investigator that she, Arius, was not attentive and wouldn't take care of her customers, except for males. He also complained of having to redirect her to wait on customers to do her job, as well as her refusal to work on Sundays. While her inconsistent work history did not touch on the issue of her self-defense claim, it did offer a small window into Arius's life away from Travis. She approached her work unenthusiastically, not caring about the quality of her service, perhaps because she knew the next server job was just an application away. I then turned my attention to reading about Arius's educational history. According to her academic transcripts, she had dropped out of Wairika High School after her junior year, and there was no record that she had ever returned to obtain her diploma or that she had earned a GED. Looking closely at her transcripts revealed that she had been achieving top grades and accolades from all of her teachers during her freshman and sophomore years, and was enrolled in honors English courses for both years. But her academic performance dropped dramatically in the 11th grade, which she completed with mostly Fs and a few Ds. During her junior year, Arius had moved in with her grandparents because of tension at home with her mother. In an interview with the defense investigator, Arius's maternal grandmother, Caroline Allen, recalled waking her granddaughter up in the mornings and believing that once she left the house, she was heading for school. Only later did she learn that Jody was ditching classes to hang out with a young man named Bobby Juarez, who family members described as a high school boyfriend. Like her employment record, Arius's educational history, while interesting background, really didn't touch on the self-defense claim in any way, so I turned my attention to the conversations that the investigator had summarized with other members of Arius's family, which included her parents, Bill and Sandy, her three siblings, Carl, Joey, and Angela, her half-sister, Julie, her maternal grandfather, Carlton Sonny Allen, a cousin, and two aunts. I was surprised to read that nearly everyone that the investigator spoke with echoed what Arias's parents had told Detective Flores in their initial interview with him, that Jody could be hurtful and unkind, especially to her mother. She would regularly call the house and out of nowhere berate her mother for the strangest of reasons before suddenly slamming down the phone. As the family members told it, one time Jody called her mother to say she had just gotten a haircut. When Sandy said it probably looked nice, Jody became upset and started screaming at her. Her parents also said that on at least two occasions, there were incidents that had turned physical. Bill Arias recalled one time when Jody hit her mother for no apparent reason, and he smacked his daughter in response. Arias's half-sister Julie recounted another incident when Jody and Sandy were sitting side by side. Sandy lightly touched Jody, and Jody kicked her mother in response. Arias's childhood friend, Zaina Carranzo, told the investigator of a trouble-filled relationship between Arias and her mother. She informed the investigator that she and Arias first met at Los Padres Elementary School in Salinas, California, and they remained close even after Arias moved to Santa Maria and then to Yreka. While Zaina expressed great fondness for her childhood pal, whom she described as very bright, hilarious, and like a sister to her, she admitted that when Arias got angry, she really laid into her mother, who tried to control and calm her, but Arias wouldn't listen and was grounded a lot because she was so defiant. Even when she knew the consequences, Arias just didn't care, Zaina said, telling the investigator that of Bill and Sandy's four children, Jody was the most unruly. She would say to Sandy, "I hate you. I wish you weren't my mother," Zaina recounted, remembering one time when Arias kicked a hole in the wall because her mother was angry with her. Reading through this, it was not lost on me that Zaina was the only friend who had been interviewed by the defense investigator, leading me to suspect that Arias was a person who had difficulty bonding with and keeping friends, especially women. Thinking back, this point emphasized why the police's decision to send Siskiyou County Detective Rachel Blaney into the interview room with Arias had not yielded the desired results. Arias's troubled relationship with her mother and the glaring absence of any interviews with female friends other than Zaina illustrated her inability to relate to women in the same effortless way she had of connecting with men. Other family members' interviews further complicated the portrait of Arias's relationship with her family. Her brother Carl described his sister as someone who tended to live above her means and wondered if her extravagant spending habits, such as driving an expensive car when she had no money, coupled with her tendency to overreact and blow up at people for no reason, pointed to mental illness, such as bipolar disorder. He cited as an example her out-of-the-blue phone calls to her parents' house, during which she would yell and shriek and then hang up. More interesting was the disturbance Carl described between Arias and her father after her recent move back to Yreka. Carl explained that at his sister's request, their father had rented a storage shed for her, but said she grew belligerent when she saw the unit, yelling and calling her father stupid for choosing the wrong size. Arias's cousin, Amy Lance, said Jody would be snide at family functions and speak sarcastically to others. Amy's assessment was that Jody could be a total bitch. This sentiment was echoed by Jody's maternal grandparents, the Allens, who said their granddaughter would correct the way people spoke. They mentioned that if you talked to her, you had to use perfect grammar and speech. These descriptions were in line with what her parents had told Detective Flores, and it struck me just how out of step this collective illustration was with the idyllic childhood Arias had described to Flores. The woman detailed in these records was a huge departure from the demure, soft-spoken one who had presented herself during her conversations after her arrest in Yreka and her jailhouse interviews with the national media. As I read on, a different composite began to emerge, one of a churlish grammar tyrant who was mean to her mother and seemed to derive pleasure from belittling and correcting others. Her family perceived Jody as someone who would react in unpredictable ways, even when people were being kind to her. This theme kept arising in these statements, usually as it pertained to her mother. While having a nasty temper did not prove her a murderer, it did demonstrate a pattern of behavior when it came to how she interacted with people about whom she purported to care. She could clearly be cruel, volatile, and impulsive when the mood struck her. Perhaps the most striking thing about these interviews was how replete they were with negative tales of her background. After all, this was a composite that was prepared by her defense team and meant to portray her in a positive light. Instead, the picture of her that emerged was anything but positive. Even when speaking to someone who was sympathetic to Jody's cause and trying to help her defense, it seemed her family could not help but show the true nature of Jody Arias. As I let all of this sink in, I spent a few moments preparing some notes about what I had just read before putting the folder back on the shelf and heading out for my next appointment. It was several days before I was able to get back to the materials provided by defense counsel, but I decided to shift my attention. This time, I concentrated on some of the peculiar behaviors Arias's family described around the time of Travis's memorial service in Mesa. Detective Flores had told me that Arias had traveled to Arizona to attend the memorial service, which took place a couple of weeks after police had discovered Travis's body, and that Travis's family and friends had found her presence there both strange and disturbing. What I hadn't heard was how she had behaved after the service, which was part of the interview summary from Arias's half-sister Julie. In particular, what caught my attention was Julie's recollection of a phone call she received from Jody on her way home from the airport following her return from Mesa. Jody wanted to stop by and asked what time dinner would be served. She told Julie she would be at the house in a few minutes, but more than an hour passed before she finally arrived. Julie was shocked and upset when Jody told her that she had been out shopping for bikinis and lost track of time, finding her indifference to Travis's death especially disturbing in light of the fact that she had just attended his memorial service. Even more strange was Jody's admission that she had exchanged phone numbers with a man named Nick, who was seated next to her on the flight from Phoenix to Sacramento. Julie said she was bewildered that her sister would so freely give her contact information to a stranger, and mortified when she heard them talking on the phone later that evening. Even more puzzling was that Julie never saw Jody cry after Travis's memorial service. Instead, she appeared agitated and nervous and was always on the phone. That Arias chose to go bikini shopping on her way home from Travis's memorial service raised obvious questions about what she was thinking and how she was reacting. If she had killed Travis in self-defense, it appeared she had not been upset or fazed by it, and had moved on in more ways than one. Arias's younger sister, Angela, also provided some insight. Because she was a minor, she spoke to the defense investigator in the company of her parents. Angela proudly described herself as just like Jody, explaining that they both liked to sing, they were both very musical, and they both preferred to be alone rather than with people. But there was one important detail that caught my attention as it related to Ryan Burns, the man Arias claimed to have been meeting in Utah on the day of Travis's death. Though Arias had only met Ryan once, Angela recalled Jody telling her how much she liked him, that he was her soulmate, and that she was convinced the two would get married. Arias's strange behavior following Travis's death didn't end there. Even after her arrest in Yreka, Julie found her half-sister's demeanor peculiar for someone who was facing murder charges. She said Jody was always upbeat and happy, beginning all of their calls with a cheerful, "What's up?" She next described a postcard she received from her sister in April 2009, thanking her for saying a few kind words to the Californian, referring to an article that had appeared in a Salinas newspaper. "Everyone else in the family stands by and lets me get slaughtered by ignorant, hateful, judgmental people," Arias wrote. Bill and Sandy Arias also referenced their daughter's strange contentment when they had first visited with her at the Siskiyou County Jail. "She was happy as hell," Bill recalled. Bill recounted a phone call he received from his daughter when she was told that a psychiatrist would be evaluating her in jail as part of her defense claim. He related Jody's excitement at learning that she would undergo an IQ test as part of the examination and was eager to see how close her IQ was to Albert Einstein's. "She thinks she is close to his IQ," Bill told the investigator. Her father's comment reminded me of Arias's bravado in the days after Travis's body had been discovered, when she thought she could outwit the police by offering to help with the investigation. She'd clearly had a lot of faith in her intelligence, but comparing herself to Einstein showed just how much faith she really had. Looking back over the statements of her family, it seemed clear that Arias reveled in her newfound celebrity status and seemed to enjoy being the center of attention, even if it was behind bars. She acted as if the television interviews and newspaper stories were a just reward for a major accomplishment, even if that accomplishment was killing Travis. 4 hours had passed since I'd started reading, and I had missed lunch, so I was beginning to feel hungry. I have never fallen into the habit of eating or drinking at my desk when reviewing paperwork, not even a sip of water, as I have seen too many attorneys spill liquids or leave food smudges on shirts, ties, and important documents that then can't be wiped clean. I always eat away from my desk, whether it be at our office lunchroom or downstairs at the tables outside the Change of Venue Cafe on the second floor, or at one of the restaurants near my office in downtown Phoenix, depending on how pressed for time I am. It was already past 4 p.m. when I decided to give myself a break. My body was beginning to cramp from sitting hunched over the desk, so I took the stairs down 2 levels to get the blood circulating. I was still feeling frustrated when I reached the vending machines on the second floor and bought a snack. While the information I had read thus far had been enlightening in terms of presenting another side of Arias, none of it would be useful in disproving her allegation of self-defense, and I was nearly halfway through with my read. When I got back to my desk, I moved on to the conversations the investigator had summarized with two of Arias's former boyfriends. Based on what I had already read, it was clear that her family members knew very little about her life in the 11 years since she had left home. So I looked to her boyfriends to provide the best window into what happened to her during that time. In reading these interview summaries, I learned that Arias had been involved in 3 significant relationships before Travis. The first was with Bobby Juarez, the young man she had met in the 11th grade. Her parents told the investigator that Jody stayed with her grandparents until her 18th birthday, when she moved in with Bobby and his parents in a neighboring town. There was no interview with Bobby included in the materials provided by Arias's defense counsel, and by all accounts, Arias appeared to have lost touch with Bobby after that. Also, according to the summaries, Arias's brother Carl told the investigator that his sister's next relationship was with Matthew McCartney, an individual he described as strange, with long black hair, who had an interest in the martial arts. He remembered their relationship as volatile, with the two constantly fighting, breaking up, and getting back together. The investigator followed up by speaking with McCartney, who was living in Big Sur, California, and working as a waiter at the Ventana Inn and Spa, an upscale resort where Arias had once been employed. He told the investigator that Arias had been hired to work at the Ventana Inn before he followed and was also hired. He said they lived together in a tent on the resort's campground for a short period of time. McCartney said he met Arias through her ex-boyfriend Bobby Juarez. He and Bobby were roommates, sharing an apartment in Medford, California, when she showed up there one afternoon. He saw her as perfect. Perfect body, very creative, very intelligent. Apparently, the fact that McCartney and Juarez were roommates did not bother Arias, as she and McCartney subsequently went on to date for about 2.5 years. The two remained friends after the breakup. He described her as having two different sides, a serious side and an innocent, fun, and sweet side, acknowledging that she could be emotionally volatile and had high expectations of others. McCartney told the investigator that Arias had a lack of grammatical tolerance. He explained that she couldn't accept the way he communicated and directed him to be impeccable with his words because she needed exact communication to understand him. He corroborated this to me later when he told me during an interview in Seaside, California in July 2011 that Arias was a grammar Nazi who would constantly correct him. McCartney admitted that he would always love Arias, but said they could never be more than friends. He explained that toward the end of their relationship, he felt they needed to spend time apart, so he moved to Crater Lake in Oregon. He broke off sexual relations before he moved out. Although he tried to end the relationship, Arias was very resistant to breaking up, even going behind his back and confronting Bianca, a woman with whom he already had a nascent relationship. McCartney knew Arias's next boyfriend, Daryl Brewer, because Brewer was his supervisor at the Ventana Inn. Brewer was also the food and beverage manager who interviewed and hired Arias in 2002. He was 20 years older than Arias and had a young son from a first marriage that had ended in divorce. Even though it was getting late, I pulled out the interview summaries with Daryl Brewer. It was already after 8 p.m., and from what I could tell, I was the only person still in the office, as not even the janitorial staff are permitted to be in the building after hours. Staying late was something I had grown accustomed to over the years. The stillness of the rooms and hallways is almost meditative and provides a tranquil backdrop that enables me to concentrate more fully. But I had an early court hearing, and I was pretty much at the end of my energy stores, so I promised myself I would skim only the first few pages of the interview summaries with Daryl Brewer before calling it a night. The defense investigator documented 3 separate conversations with Brewer. During their initial phone call, which had been brief, Brewer indicated that he was still in touch with Arias and revealed that he had advised her not to speak to anyone, particularly the media. But he said she does what she likes, and she was encouraging friends and family to sit down with producers from 48 Hours on her behalf. Brewer's second conversation with the investigator provided a little more insight into his relationship with Arias. He admitted being impressed.